It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we whisk you out of the studio to tour the University of Iowa's Operator Performance Laboratory at the Iowa City Airport. It's a lab that researches pilot training for NASA, the Defense Department, and Rockwell Collins, among others. Our tour guide is the lab's director and founder, Tom Schnell. He'll share some of the latest fascinating research he and his colleagues are doing. He'll also talk about the fundamental challenges that flight poses to our brains.
I always say it's the cave person's brain suddenly being transported into the Jet Age or even the Space Age.
The frontiers of aeronautic research. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour, very special hour, I get out of the studio. I'm sitting actually right now in a test aircraft in a hangar at the Operator Performance Laboratory in the Center for Computer-Aided Design at the University of Iowa. I'm in the front seat of an aircraft, an L-29, in the back seat actually flying the aircraft, and we are flying it in simulation in the back seat. Founder and director Tom Mach Schnell. He's an associate professor of industrial engineering at the University of Iowa, founder and director of this Operator Performance Laboratory. And I'm in the front cockpit. There's some beeping going on. Tom, hello to you and welcome to our program. Thank you for inviting us here to spend an hour with you finding out what's going on in this lab.
Hey, Ben. It's real pleasure and privilege to have you here in our lab. I'm in the back seat of the L-29, and obviously you're in the front, and you've described what you're seeing as a simulation. And in fact, it's only half true because the airplane itself is fully capable of flying. We just happen to have instrumented it in such a way that when it's on the ground, it can double up as a flight simulator with screens in the front of it that allow our test subjects to be exposed to an experiment on the ground first, so that when we go up in the air and we repeat the experiment, that there's no questions about exactly what the expectations are and what they're supposed to do. So it helps us to really fine-tune the evolutions that will go on in the air, because once you're taking off in a fighter jet-type aircraft like this with what's called a tandem seat configuration, it's really hard to communicate with each other in any other way than over the intercom. I don't see you, and I wouldn't see your hand gesture or body language. So we use the system to really kind of home in on the procedures that we'll be experiencing when we go up and do flight testing.
And Tom, as you take us through the operations here at the laboratory, I want to mention to our listeners that they can go online and see a short video of what that cockpit looks like in the L-29, the test aircraft that you have here that you just described. Also some photos from our visit by going to iowapublicradio.org and searching for River to River. It may come as a surprise to many of our listeners, as it has to me, that military pilots are here in Iowa training for missions, for conflicts, right here in Iowa. It has to do with this lab, and it combines simulation with actual flying. Tell us about that.
So, to be more accurate, we're not really training them here. We're developing the systems that one day will allow such training to occur in the different training ranges, such as Nellis or Fallon or other places that people might have heard of. The underlying idea is this, that the most modern fighters are so capable, they're so-called fifth-gen fighters, that they can go out and fight many adversaries of the fourth or third-generation kind. And if you wanted to give a flight of four fifth-gen fighters, a really interesting training evolution, you would have to put out so many aggressor airplanes that we just don't have enough of them. So at Nellis or places like that, there's actually pilots who train the tactics of aggressor nations, and they fly F-16 aircraft or similar nimble aircraft that mimic the characteristics of an aggressor nation's fleet of aircraft, and they go out and they will engage in air-to-air combat, simulated as it may be, over the U.S. test ranges and giving those fifth-gen fighter pilots an ability to train. The problem is we just don't have enough opposing force aircraft that we can deploy in such a fight. And so we tend to simulate those sparring partners using electronic means rather than real aircraft.
So describe how this aircraft that I was sitting in, how that works. It actually comes out of this hangar. It's a real aircraft. It happens to be hooked up to some simulation equipment right now, but you can take it out of this this hangar and fly it. Describe for me an exercise, something that you would do with that aircraft that combines the real flying capability of that aircraft with the simulation, and why it makes sense to mix the simulation with the real flying.
So for us, there's different reasons. One is it's obviously not an F-35. It's a former East Bloc 1970s era fighter jet trainer. So the fact that we can take simulation into the air gives us the ability to kind of put a sheep into a wolf's skin, if you will, and give that airplane capabilities that mimic what the fifth-gen fighter could do, not so much in terms of pulling Gs, but in terms of its electronic displays and capabilities. So from a testing point of view, that's very valuable. Exercises that we've done and really demonstrations or development thrusts involve the connection between people that make decisions. So there's a person on the ground called a Joint Terminal Attack Controller, or JTAC. That's a specialist who will be co-located with our troops that might require an airstrike being conducted. And the JTAC is the person who knows how to talk to the airborne element, the pilot, that's coming in a way that will achieve the objective, which is destroy the target that needs to be destroyed without collateral damage or fratricide or something undesirable along those lines. The problem is JTACs are actually finding themselves in a tough spot to get adequate training because there might be a unit in Peoria and the next training range where they could go and do a live control on a fighter jet, dropping a simulated or real weapon, they'd have to travel for thousands of miles to go and execute that exercise. With the technology that we're developing here, the unit in Peoria could literally plug in a box that where he would be wearing something like an Oculus Rift virtual reality goggle, plug into the internet. His view now suddenly has been transformed into an area of combat. It could be Afghanistan or whatever you want. And he sees the view from where he will be in actual theater. Then he connects to an airplane that doesn't have to be in Peoria or Afghanistan. In our case, it's actually flying in Iowa, 20,000 feet up in the air, south of Iowa City. And the guy in the back seat of our airplane experiences the same exact scenario that happens in virtual, say, Afghanistan. And so the two guys, the JTAC and the pilot, can interact with each other the way they would once they go to theater and do exactly what they're doing with all the complexities and fog of war difficulties that you cannot really simulate when you go to a training exercise in a U.S.-based range. So we can make it way more complex, way more difficult for the aircrew and the JTAC to handle.
So, Tom, you brought us into another room here at the Operator Performance Laboratory at the University of Iowa. Tom Schnell is the founder and director. In a glass case, we have a helmet on some styrofoam heads here. Tell us what this represents.
What you're seeing here is a very early prototype of the helmet that is now being fielded for the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35. All fighter jets today have what's called a head-up display, which is a see-through display that's mounted on top of the glare shield, and the pilot can see certain symbologies on it, like how fast am I going, how high I am, what's the status of my weapons and where are my enemies. The helmet provides the same information. So in the F-35, you no longer have a head-up display. It's actually part of what you're wearing, and there's displays mounted on top of the helmet that reflect images right into the pilot's eyes so that wherever he looks, you get a picture of the real world, be that sensor-generated or augmented with additional information such as distance to a threat, what it is, and so forth. The significance of this technology as it relates to Iowa is that the company Rockwell Collins is actually building many parts of that helmet. So the optics and the electronics related to the helmet are being made by Rockwell Collins. And we are probably one of the very few organizations in the world that have a helmet like this. And I'm not talking about the mock-up here. I'm talking about the real thing and integrated it with our aircraft. So we can now go and do research for, in this case, for the Air Force and figure out what can be done to give pilots who are wearing this kind of a system additional spatial orientation cues, so when they're upside down or in an unusual attitude at night, that they can see which way to go, and it becomes a very naturalistic extension of the real-world experience.
Is this going back to the idea of, you mentioned the Oculus Rift, what we know now, the virtual reality goggles? Is it something like that with additional things added?
Exactly, except in the Oculus Rift, you cannot see through, right? So you don't see the real world. I would say it's closer to Iron Man. So if you know what that looked like from Tony Stark's point of view, that's pretty much what we're talking about.
If you just joined us, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, coming to you this hour from the Operator Performance Laboratory in the Center for Computer-Aided Design at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. I'm talking mainly with its founder and director, Tom Mach-Schnell. He's an associate professor of industrial engineering at the University of Iowa. We're looking at how pilots are trained and research on pilot training that's going on right here in the University of Iowa. A fascinating combination of real-life flying with aircraft. I'm sitting in a hangar with several different aircraft that combines with simulation to improve on training for pilots. Tom, I understand one of the core issues that you're dealing with in aviation, and not just military, but also commercial aviation research, focuses on the loss of control due to spatial disorientation. Any pilot has a brain. We are all humans, and yet we have to move through this space sometimes at incredible speeds and in really orientations that defy the way our brains were built to experience space.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I always say it's the Mark I cave person's brain suddenly being transported into the Jet Age or even the Space Age, if you will. Physiologically, we're really not well equipped with our internal sense of balance to know which way an airplane is oriented. The way we do it as pilots is we look outside and we get the sense of orientation from what we see with our eyes. That's called visual dominance. Humans are very visually dominant. If the sense of vision is available, we tend to use it almost to the utmost degree for our orientation in the world. The problem is, at night or in inclement weather, we still want to continue flying, be that commercially or the military. They need to operate in all weather. So now you can't see. That means you have to rely on instruments that, in a sense, mimic what's going on outside, except now it's being done on small 3-inch in diameter gauges that contain an artificial horizon or other instrumentation that tell you how high the aircraft is.
Explain as simply as you can what happens when we become disoriented as a pilot. Is it the fact that some of our senses are telling us we're doing one thing and maybe our eyes are telling us we're doing another thing? What is happening in cases of disorientation?
So our vestibular system, that's the sense of balance, how we can tell which way is up and down, it's really designed for walking speeds at 5 miles an hour and standing in what we call a 1G or one gravity environment. As soon as you take an airplane and you start banking it and not losing altitude, you apply what we call G forces, and those are the forces you feel that push you in the seat. I could take you up in this airplane here and put us upside down and still have positive G forces applied, kind of like in a corkscrew barrel roll type maneuver, and you would never know that you're upside down because your inner ear and your otolith organ inside the inner ear would actually believe wherever it feels the chi, the direction of that is down, even though that point may be pointing right up in the sky, and it becomes very disorienting if you don't know how to read the instruments, if you don't see the outside world.
So tell us, how do we then adapt what you said is this caveman brain to understand something beyond what the caveman brain was designed to do? What's in the cockpit going on? What technical help do we have to understand what we need to in order to keep the aircraft from flying into the ground or to do it much more, in fact?
I think there's only one way, and that's try to restore the sensation that you have when you do fly on a beautiful day. So we're trying to restore visual dominance by giving the aircrew a picture on the instrument panel or maybe even in the helmet, which projects the imagery right into your facial visor and make that picture so compelling that it's as good or maybe even better than the real world. In other words, it no longer matters what you see out the window because you can substitute it with an electronic facsimile of that picture and make it in many ways better because you can add information that wouldn't even be there in the real world. Orientation, where am I? Well, you can put words into that synthetic picture that you can now look at, and it would say Iowa River, Iowa City, and things like that. Guidance to things like airports could be and have been implemented with what we call a highway in the sky, where it literally becomes as easy as following a ribbon in 3D space that leads you from wherever you are to the nearest airport of your destination and all the way down to a approach from where you can then land with natural vision.
So right now in your research that has to do with spatial disorientation, we hear there are, of course, aircraft crashes. We've had several notable crashes within the last few months in the United States, in the world. Do you happen to know how many crashes are due to problems we have not solved for pilots in terms of disorientation?
So speaking of that, what you hear maybe on the roof of this building is inclement weather. So there have been crashes associated with inclement weather, rain, fog, night. A review of accidents in the International Jet Fleet reveals that actually the U.S. is doing really pretty good. There's something on the order of about 1,800 fatalities that occurred in the worldwide jet fleet in the last 10 years. And the two themes that we see that occur is loss of control due to loss of energy awareness. That will be your crashes like Asiana, where the crew had no concept of how much energy they were losing out of the airplane. And then when they realized that it was too late and they stalled the airplane and had no recourse to add power back into the system fast enough. Then there's other crashes that would relate more to spatial disorientation. And if a crew is suddenly unsure which way is up and down, the response you almost unanimously see them do is pull back on the controls, which is not always the right response, but it is an instinctive response that happens quickly and sometimes to the detriment of the crew. And so one aspect that helps make this possible is the fact that flight training nowadays has become more electronically aided through autopilots and flight management system. And so the pure stick and rudder skills have and are continuing to somewhat be eroded. That means pilots are now flying advanced aircraft and don't really have the stick and rudder skills that some pilots of years in the past used to have.
So is there a limit to how much you should automate for a pilot? Are you taking the pilot away from the flying experience to a level that perhaps is dangerous for the pilot and any passengers?
It's not dangerous because, you know, anytime someone wants to turn aviation into a sensational accident sort of scenario, I would remind them that it's been 1,800 fatalities in 10 years when, in fact, on U.S. highways, we kill something like 30, 40,000 people a year. And it's not very spectacular because it happens one accident at a time. So aviation is safe. Even the way we do it right now, with all the limitations that we can improve upon, we're really kind of polishing the gem a little bit. If you fly hundreds of hours, and of those hundreds of hours, let's say 100 hours, and you're flying 95 hours or maybe 98 hours on autopilot, you'll get proficient at using that autopilot. But if the autopilot says, I had enough because the envelope of where the aircraft is in is beyond what the autopilot can do, it gives you an airplane that's basically out of control, out of envelope, and now within a half a second you have to go from being more or less a passenger watching the whole thing occur to trying to intervene, make the proper control inputs, and we find that pilots can't always do that successfully. So that switch from being a supervisor to suddenly the person who needs to save the day is one that becomes difficult to manage if you don't have any training opportunities to be a stick and rudder pilot.
So what are those MARs, those imperfections that your research here at the University of Iowa with your team is trying to buff out? What are the problems with that gem?
We want to make flying more naturalistic in the sense when I take my 1940s Stearman biplane, I don't really need any instruments. I can hear my airspeed by the sound of the engine. I can feel it with the wind in my hair or over the top of my head. I can feel how the controls are getting stiff or loose based on the speed. It's almost like having your hand on the tiller of a sailboat. That is a very connected experience of flight. And you truly fly almost like a bird. Counter that with the experience a commercial airliner captain has. All you really hear is the white noise from the windshield. It doesn't hardly change as a function of the speeds that they operate at. The engines are so far back, you don't hear them, and you're connected to the flight controls through a computer that really removes you from this experience. And so that connectedness is something that we would like to put back in. And I think that the easiest way to start doing that is through better instrumentation. That is, displays in your instrument panel that at least provide a visual representation that comes very close to what the real world would look like.
Coming up, my tour of the University of Iowa's Operator Performance Laboratory continues. When we come back, I'll talk with director and founder Tom Schnell about the future of unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, as many of us know them, pilot fatigue, and also we'll talk about the career outlook for pilots getting into the field today. That's when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Do you hear me now? Listen now. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and I'm with the founder and director of the Operator Performance Laboratory in the Center for Computer-Aided Design at the University of Iowa, getting out of the studio to see what's going on at facilities at the Iowa City Airport. The founder and director, Tom Mach Schnell, he's an associate professor of industrial engineering at the University of Iowa, looking at some of the research and training going on here to improve pilot effectiveness and safety in all kinds of air travel. It can be commercial, can be military, and we're exploring some of the facets of the research going on here at the University of Iowa. Tom, what makes the research here unique, unlike research anywhere else.
The fact that we can take psychological experiments and put them into a real-world fighter jet-type package and go fly it, I don't think that's being done very many places that I'm aware of.
Psychological experiment like what?
Workload. So we measure how hard the pilot's brain is working as they're trying to solve a puzzle, like which way am I oriented without being able to see outside. It's one thing to do that in a simulator. It's a whole other thing to do that in the actual environment where the measurements are hard to do, but when you are successful in doing that, you don't have to wonder how that research transfers to the real world because it's already in the real world.
You talked about energy state awareness and something else called attitude awareness. What is the difference between those?
So big airplanes like a 777, like the Asiana aircraft, they fly because of energy. Everyone sort of understands that basic concept. An airplane can have energy in the form of kinetic energy, that's forward speed, or potential energy, that is being high. I could be way high at 40,000 feet and be almost zero airspeed. I can then stick the nose of the aircraft down and trade that height, if you will, back into airspeed. So when you go downhill, it speeds up. And so now I've taken energy from my potential energy bin and put it into my kinetic energy bin. And you can trade it back and forth. And of course, the engines are another part that supply mostly kinetic energy that I can use to go from ground sea level up to high altitudes. And so if I run out of energy, the airplane won't fly. Simple as that. And so the knowledge of where my energy is it in my potential energy height bin or in my kinetic energy bin? As long as you have some energy, you're in good shape. The problem is when you get close to the ground for a landing, the goal is to run out of both kinds of energy when the tires touch the ground, or almost be out of it anyway. You don't want to lose that amount of energy when you're still 2 miles away from the airport, because then you'll actually have something that'll look like Asiana that crashed in San Francisco 2 years ago.
Okay, Tom Schnell, founder and director of the Operator Performance Laboratory at the University of Iowa. We're in a hangar there, and we have the which you call the L-29, an old East Block jet aircraft that you use here. Next to that is a helicopter, and then we have what looks to be a Cessna. I don't know if I got that right.
Yes, you did. So that the helicopter is a MIL Mi-2 hoplite helicopter. It's also an East Block helicopter, and it's our model to use East Block airframes because they're affordable. They're actually very simple, they're rugged, and they fit our bill perfectly. What we then do is we take out all the old-fashioned analog electronics and we make a big pile out of it and kind of call it a museum piece, and then we replace all that space that now has been carved out in these airframes with very modern, sophisticated avionics. So don't let the helicopter fool you. This is probably the world's most sophisticated electronics in any helicopter anywhere in the world. And I'm not just saying that. I can take you over there and show to you the types of things that are in that helicopter that make a pilot's life much, much easier navigating in inclement weather.
Okay, let's take a walk over there, Tom, and have you tell us about it. Okay, I'm glad to see, even though this helicopter came from the East Block, it now has Herky the Hawk on the side of it. A fighting Herky the Hawk. So tell us about this aircraft.
So this helicopter was built in 1978 in Poland, and it then served in the Bulgarian army and was brought over here a few years ago. I don't know exactly when. I picked it up in Dallas in a museum, a flying museum, so it was in flyable condition, but it was perfect for our mission. We then brought it up here, and we, like I said before, gutted the instrument panel. We pretty much took out all the old avionics junk that was in there and replaced it with very sophisticated equipment that we got from Rockwell Collins. This is the same equipment that you would see in a CH-47F model Chinook. Sometimes you see them flying overhead, those big helicopters with two big rotors on the top. That's the same equipment, except it's fair to say that ours has a few additional tricks up its sleeve. It has very high-resolution synthetic vision, giving the pilot that elusive view of what the world would look like if you could see it. So you can fly in inclement weather and see a very detailed picture of the world ahead of you on those instrument panel displays.
And this aircraft, also this helicopter, also flies?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We fly this quite frequently. And so you might see us flying around the Iowa City airport. It's camouflage painted. And it does look a little bit like an animal. It has a nose on the front that kind of looks a little bit comical, but under that nose is actually a very sophisticated piece of electronics. It's a radar made by Rockwell Collins that provides both a view of weather phenomena that are ahead of you, so rain and microbursts and things like that, but also a map of the ground below you using radar returns. But in addition, if you see that helicopter, you see kind of like stubby wings. We call them outriggers, and on those outriggers hangs equipment that scanned the world below using a laser beam that gives us an extremely detailed map of what's below us to the point where the pilot can now see power lines, towers, and wires, trees, and other things that might not be compatible with flying through them.
Okay, Tom Schnell, if you've just joined us, is the founder and director of the Operator Performance Laboratory at the University of Iowa. All kinds of aircraft, not only aircraft, but land craft as well. He puts them through the paces and researches them, how pilots operate, operators, the challenges that they deal with. And if you'd like to see some of the images from this laboratory, all you need to do is go to iowapublicradio.org, search for River to River, and we'll have a picture of Tom there in this Polish helicopter, refurbished for research. And Tom, you can get in there. We'll get a picture of you to put on our website, and this helicopter with a funny nose that you just described. Well, as we've heard in our news, we're reminded so often in our news, we have entered the age of drones. You have at least a few drones here in your hangar. Tell us what they are and how you're using them for research.
So my most important quest is to try to educate the public to not call them drones. And that's a tough challenge. I think that's the hardest part about it. They should be called unmanned aircraft systems because they are actually aircraft. The term drone comes from the old days where automated aircraft were put up in training ranges for fighter pilots to go shoot them down. Clearly, we're well beyond what that technology was. And today's unmanned aircraft will serve very many purposes. You know, here for Iowa, I would say the killer application is going to be precision agriculture, where they will help farmers to go from a farming management area of per acre down to the per bean or per corn stalk type of management. Where is the plant? How deep was its seed put in? What kind of nutrients did it get? A lot of that information can be gleaned from flying over top of these crops with aircraft that will take multispectral images and give the farmer a much better ability to know where inside of a field nutrients ought to be applied. And I think it's all consistent with being good stewards with the environment, because you can, in the future, get away with a lot less nutrients being just kind of bombed across the entire field, whereas now you could go and deploy it in a much more precision-oriented way.
So specifically, these unmanned aircraft are being used here for what? What are you doing with them?
So the biggest challenge in taking unmanned aircraft systems and integrate them in the U.S. airspace system is really see and avoid. And somehow these automated systems need to learn to be at least as good as a human pilot in seeing and avoiding threats. So if you want to go into precision agriculture with an unmanned system and you start mixing ag airplanes, spray planes with unmanned aircraft, you have to somehow make sure that both can avoid. And I know the manned aircraft can already do that quite effectively, but we now need to develop technology to give that same ability to the unmanned system so that it can know the rules of the air, if you will.
Mm-hmm. How many years would you say are we away from having unmanned aircraft be able to detect threats, avoid threats as well, and then, I'm assuming, eventually better than humans can as pilots?
It could be a small number of years. I'm kind of hedging my answer here a little bit because it's really difficult to do. Not only is it the technological challenge, but then you have to go do formal proofs that your system works in all conditions that matter, including inclement weather, including day and night and other situations that might arise. That proof is called certification. And really, I think 10 years would be kind of a fair guess. But keep in mind, the pressure from the industrial stakeholders is huge. There's a lot of push behind getting larger and smaller UAVs into the airspace system.
So the picture I'm getting from you is something from an old cartoon that we all know well, the Jetsons, a skyline that is filled with manned and unmanned vehicles zipping back and forth from homes over large and small distances and heights that vary from almost ground level to very high.
Yeah, that vision has been almost as old as airplanes, and we still don't have it. So I'm guardedly optimistic that we'll do all the right things, but the reality is going to look more like aviation and how we have it today, minus the pilot, and much less like the Jetsons. So I believe you'll see that the heavier, bigger unmanned aircraft are going to be flown by individuals who have certifications and qualifications and credentials similar to or the same as manned aircraft pilots. So the idea that, you know, you're Mr. Jetson and you hop into something that takes you across the sky somewhere else, I don't know if I'm going to live long enough to see that happen. And I'm not even sure that I'm interested in that whole vision. I'm certainly thinking the human needs to be involved at some level. You know, if you think in terms of passenger transport, the idea that you would send an airliner full of people without a pilot up is just escapes me. I don't see that happening in our lifetimes. There's just too many ethical conundrums along those lines that I believe there's going to be a pilot on those.
Tom Mach-Schnell is with me, and rather I'm with him because I'm in his lab. It's the Operator Performance Laboratory in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. He's the founder and director of this Operator Performance Laboratory. We're gladly being given a tour around this hangar, which includes all kinds of interesting aircraft and land craft as well. So for people working in the industry, what is the outlook for pilots, for others working in aviation? What is the future of it?
If someone wants to be an airline pilot, they know it. And there's nothing you can put in their way to prevent them from going that career path. And I've seen that time and again. It's a calling. And in my opinion, I would always encourage that. Remove obstacles to the extent that I can. But I also would be cautioning them that they are, in fact, in a difficult career path where you might be furloughed multiple times, be working not near your home, and have a lot of hotel quality time. So that's not for everybody. But I would also say there's other ways how you can be engaged in aviation, and that's to go get yourself an engineering degree. Doesn't have to be aerospace engineering. As much as I like Iowa State, that they have an excellent program, the fundamentals of engineering, such as electrical or mechanical engineering, are just the perfect background for working in the aerospace field, and it's going to accelerate. With the unmanned aircraft, the demand for good engineering, quality understanding of systems and how they connect, communicate with each other. It's just a tremendous growth industry. You cannot go wrong by becoming an engineer.
In March of 2015, we had the crash of the German Wings flight 9525 crashing into the French Alps with 150 people on board. It was a crash that happened after the co-pilot locked the captain out of the cabin and initiated a descent into the ground. When we're dealing with a human factor like that, mental illness, is there anything that technology can do? Did you and the people at the lab here react and say, there's something as a threat we have to eliminate and perhaps technology can help?
So first of all, this couldn't happen in the U.S. We don't allow crew members to be remaining sole occupants in the cockpit. That's sort of the administrative methodology that will probably make this a lot less feasible or possible, having two people in the cockpit at all times. The fundamental protection that you could give avionics is that, you know, think of it like a horse. Horses will maneuver on their own. They will take your commands as well. You can do tight reins, loose reins. Avionics should be the same way. So I can guide them wherever I want to go. I can make them jump over things, kind of like a horse. But if I demand something that the horse would know is going to kill it or hurt it, it'll probably throw the rider off. Avionics could be given the same sort of behavioral cues. You know, they could be aware of where the ground is, and there's no legitimate reason for a flight path vector, so the trajectory, to be pointed into the middle of the French Alps when there's no other faults being detected on the aircraft. So the information would exist. Strapping it together into a protective system that will avoid flying into man-made buildings and things like that intentionally, maliciously, that could be put into an aircraft. But you also have to be very sure that in no way, shape, or form would it ever interfere in a way when you have to do something with the airplane in an emergency, such as landing in the Hudson, and the last thing you need to have is an airplane telling you you can't go land in the Hudson or some other place. So it's a really tough design challenge to know exactly what's going on all the time in all the crazy circumstances that could actually come up and exist in the real world. It's way, way easier to just kind of go 20/20 hindsight and critique everyone involved in the industry with how they could have prevented that. Well, they would have if they could have. It's something we need to constantly work on, and many times administrative oversight in the sense of like two people on the flight deck will probably go farther than pure technology interventions would.
As we wind up this tour, our little visit to your operator performance laboratory, I'm just curious about you a little bit, Thomas Schnell. Your accent tells me that you're not from any of the regions here in Iowa, and perhaps further away is where your origins are. How did you come to Iowa to found this lab for pilot research, operator research?
I grew up in Switzerland, in a town near Bern, Switzerland, the capital, and early on got into model airplanes. So I was definitely an early adopter of RC airplanes when that kind of started, and had many great mentors who were real pilots of flying real airplanes. School kind of got in the way of that, and I had to go to college and get a degree and all that. And I did that as an electrical engineer in Bern, Switzerland, and then went to work every day as a software developer and kind of got a little bit the chills, you know, thinking I'm going to do that until I'm 65. So I had to change something because it started to worry me. And the change was go back to school and add more schooling to your background, but I didn't want to do that in Zurich or someplace like that. In fact, I truly always admired the United States. I was always read up on things going on in the U.S., Apollo and all the space shuttle stuff, and was just fascinated. So to me, it was a dream coming over here. It was supposed to be a short stint just for 2 years to get my master's degree, but my advisor at Ohio U kind of worked on me to go pursue a PhD, and like, well, okay, why not? You know, that could be useful. So I did that, and then by that time, you know, got into aviation and really started liking it, and was eventually recruited up to Iowa by Dan McGeehee, who you've been having on your program before. And so one thing led to another, and here I am.
Well, Tom Schnell, founder and director of the Operator Performance Laboratory at the University of Iowa, this has been a fascinating tour, a fascinating visit. I want to thank you very much. I'm sure our listeners have been delighted to hear about some of the very special research going on here in Iowa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
And a reminder to our listeners that some pictures and videos of Tom Schnell's lab will be put together with the podcast posting at iowapublicradio.org. And that's it for this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It took us out of the studio to the Operator Performance Laboratory at the University of Iowa. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. The executive producer of our talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.